Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday. It is the 1st of July, a new month, a new quarter, a new half of the year. There we go. There's a lot going on. A holiday weekend we're walking into, so I hope you are with us. I know a lot of people are off. I don't know about you, Judy, but it took me like 12 minutes to get here today. I had nobody on the road.
It was wonderful. There weren't even any tractor vehicles.
Not even a cow out. No, it was. It's great. It was fantastic. So we are here. We have a great group. Let me introduce them to you, and we'll get started. And we also welcome you to join us. We do have a lot to talk about, but if you'd like to email us, panel@wamc.org is how you do it. panel@wamc.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm present.
Excellent. and the second part of that is, and accounted for, right?
That's
And accounted for.
A house full of grandchildren, all of whom make me very happy.
That's great. Well, enjoy them this weekend. That'll be a wonderful way to celebrate. You know, because nothing over the last 2 weeks has made you feel, you know, better about being an American. Freedom, independence, all those things come right to your mind. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is with us. You may know her as Heather Bruschetti, but then she got married.
Yes,
and
I did.
Heather Mulligan. So we don't have a new guest.
No.
We have a veteran guest with a new last name.
That's right. I'm trying to escape my sordid past.
So, Heather, it's wonderful to have you here. Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is with us. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
You know, I'd just like to say I love the intro music. That is my genre. That is my time.
Well, Mike Bowen, an engineer, right? Our engineer, yes. put together a nice collection of songs today having to do with Independence Day about America, and so we'll be listening to those throughout this morning. So
I'm going to go home and play them all again.
Yeah, I think you'll like what you hear this morning, and all very much in your genre. We have David Soares with us, the Albany County District Attorney. He joins us via telephone. I believe, David, if my sources are correct, and you're not lying with the pictures that you're posting on Facebook, you are in our nation's capital this morning.
Yeah, I've come here to set right the wrongs that have occurred over the last 2 weeks. So I'm here fighting for our country.
Oh, so you're going to be there for what, like 2 years?
be returning to the Capital District today, but amazing how the incredible shift in the rule of law in our nation over the last 2 weeks. It's breathtaking.
Well, could you be a little bit more specific?
Well, everything is awful.
Well, a week ago today, you know, I woke up in the country where my sisters and my mom and my daughters have less rights than I do, and that weighs incredibly heavy on me. What I do for a living is I'm in the world of public safety, and we're now told that we can pack our weapons and go everywhere we want. It's just amazing. I just don't know where to go from here.
I do want to say that with all of that, and you're absolutely right, that we take our personal moments of happiness where we can get them. And I thank you for one, the posting of your child, your beautiful, beautiful, beautiful baby girl crawling across the mall in Washington is one of the greatest pictures I've ever seen.
Well, she finally got it right. She's moving forward.
last week.
Well, they don't do that much in Washington.
Last week our country was crawling backwards, and she was too, but she moved forward. So I'm hoping that that's the direction. Mike has a great list of songs. He had me dancing. I wasn't depressed this morning. He's doing a good job. Let's keep him for another week.
Well, all right. Sounds good. Well, we'll work on keeping it as upbeat as possible this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. I don't know why. I just feel better that you're in Washington. I mean, I would love to have you here, of course, but it's just, you know, hopefully something's getting
done. I think he's meeting either with Merrick Garland or the Supreme Court. He's keeping it a mystery why he's there.
I don't know, but somewhere in his on his phone it says lunch with Ginny at 11. So,
yeah.
All right, let's get to the topics of the day, and we go to again. You know, a lot going on, and we could go in many, many different directions. I think I would like to start with the Supreme Court because a lot happened with the Supreme Court. Of course, yesterday, the two major decisions and one, of course, having to do with three major decisions yesterday. And the big one, of course, being the EPA decision, which we talked about at length with Judith Henk and others yesterday. So a lot of that we're not going to go over again, but what I found interesting was the Washington Post look at how the Supreme Court justice ruled in major decisions of 2012 and talking about this 6-3 conservative majority and these three nominees of President Donald Trump and what a impact they have had over, as the Washington Post puts it, wasting little time expanding the rights of gun owners to carry firearms in public, strengthening the role of religion in public life, and sharply curtailing the Biden administration's power to combat climate change. The Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and eliminate the nationwide right to abortion dominated one of the court's most consequential terms. Alan. David.
Well, I don't know whether Heather would agree, given some of her previous remarks in terms of the law. But I think what we're having here is pure ideological outcome-driven decision-making by the Supreme Court. It's decentralizing federal authority, putting power back into the states. It's taking all of the issues that are the tethered to, you know, right-wing conservative ideologies. That being the right to bear arms. We like that one in the First Amendment. The Second Amendment, we like that one. We also like we like religion, right? And so we'll allow for federal funding of institutions that are religious in nature. So we like that one. We also like allowing people prayer in school until it becomes a different kind of prayer, I think. And so what we're seeing is the dismantling of all of our norms. The dismantling of laws that we've come to recognize and appreciate, all of the laws that had been passed over decades and decades, demonstrating America evolving and moving forward. And we're seeing it, all of those things being pulled back in a blink of an eye and done with the amazing swiftness and speed that I didn't think could possibly happen.
Alan, you got to. I can't hear you. You got to turn.
Oh, sorry about that. It all has to do with elections too. I mean, when Americans vote, they have to know, and they vote for president, they have to know that that vote has huge consequences. I said it yesterday, and I'm going to say it again today. I don't think that we do know that as a nation. I don't think we add up one and one and make two out of it. And I think that is incredibly important, as David points out, and as we see right now.
Heather?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a different view than David, but only because of I look at the overarching theme as being the sort of historic and existential struggle between the separation of branches and the separation of power between the states and the federal government. And I think thematically, that's all of these relate to that, right? So they say, with respect to abortion, this is a state's issue. And guns, they say, states, you cannot limit the right to bear arms in this way. And I do think there's inconsistencies in the way the court has approached it, depending on the issue. There are different reasons, but on, you know, on the EPA, they're saying it's regulatory overreach. You can't, you don't have the legislative authority to do what you're trying to do with these regulations. We've had that issue at the state level as well, but it, but it's kind of an interesting angle to view sort of what I see having been really historic struggles from the beginning of the founding of our nation, right? That's always been the question. What is in the purview of the states? What is in the purview of the federal government? And as between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature, whose job is whose? And the legislature kind of got off the hook on abortion for 50 years because of the Supreme Court saying, well, this is a constitutional issue. I do think, you know, at its base, there are some of these issues where the American public is really on the other side of the Supreme Court's determination. There is another a really obvious solution, which is we can amend our Constitution. It's not easy, but if you have that much popular support for some of these issues, it's not impossible. I think this is really tumultuous times, and I will always go back to, I think casting aspersions on people based on labels is not an effective way to shift policy. I think you have to kind of go to what the core issues, identify where people are on the other side of it, and try and find some common ground rather than just saying, oh, you know, they're evil, which, and that's kind of been my defense of the justices, is I don't think they're dumb. I don't think that they're uneducated. I think that their views are maybe, or their interpretation of the Constitution is such that many of us wouldn't agree with it. And I think that, you know, they really overreached on the abortion decision in particular.
Judy.
So this, go ahead, David.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And that's okay. So this swing towards the conservatism has been happening for a few years, but you know, you think of Citizens United as a case
right.
in point.
Absolutely.
But this term was incredible, the pace at which they swung. So it's time for us to rethink our approach to the Supreme Court in the media, because the reporters have traditionally been very deferential to these justices. They do what they do in secret. They're not held accountable. It's time to start asking them some hard questions. It's time for their Senate confirmation hearings to be more than, oh, I'm not going to tell you my opinion on this because I'm a potential judge. The press has to start asking questions other than, you know, well, how do you guys get along in you know the secret society? Open up the court. Let us hear your deliberations. Is that such a far-fetched idea? Let the people know. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. It is so secretive, and we have allowed, we've given them the white glove treatment forever. It's time for them to be held just as accountable to the public as any other branch of government.
David.
Well, what I was going to say was that when the Constitution of the United States was drafted, three out of the five people on this call were never considered, okay? And along came the amendments, which, if you want to think about amendments were designed to make amends for that oversight, the intentional. So the idea that because the drafters with specificity, the 14th Amendment understood that if power continued to be decentralized and southern states would never have allowed for blacks
and former slaves to ever be integrated into society. And so the 14th Amendment created this sort of ground floor for rights, and it guaranteed that to every person, man, woman, and child. So the idea that we used federal authority to force states that were resistant to come into conformity, right? That was the greatest thing about our Constitution and our structure. So now to have a court that is going back and looking at this and attempting to decentralize that authority by saying, oh, okay, women, you no longer can govern your own, health care decisions. We'll allow the states and the legislature to do that. At a time when you have to ask, well, where are the justices living? Are they paying attention to the news? Are they taking temperature of how volatile it is politically right now in our country? Are you seeing the kind of measures that certain state legislators are passing? You can't say gay. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And so this idea that, we're strict, we're looking at the Constitution, we're looking at the history for legal precedents, and we're basing our decision in some legitimate, it doesn't ring true to me. Well, it's outcome-driven. This is what we want to do.
I have to take a quick break. Can you hold your thought?
Yep.
Okay. Won't forget it?
Nope.
Promise?
Yep.
Okay. We'll take a break. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will get back to Heather and her thought right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. I should have let that run just a couple.
Well, isn't that the Sean Hannity song?
Oh, is it?
The Martina McBride song? I don't watch Sean Hannity. I guess you do.
Radio show. It used to be his intro.
Well, two things. I'm if that's true. Sorry. Two, I would have never known that in a million years. Never heard the Sean Hannity radio show, but we'll check into it. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Alan Chartok, Heather Buschetti, David Soares, and Judy Patrick. You're listening to the roundtable panel, and thank you. In case you think this is the Sean Hannity program. Heather.
I'm supposed to have a thought that I was hanging on to. So I wanted to say I agree with David. And I think that the problem that I'm struggling with is if you look at the Supreme Court decision relating to abortion, they like totally contorted themselves to say, this is not something that was contemplated as a right by the framers of the Constitution. And therefore, you need to show a lot more history in support of this right. And it doesn't exist. And then in the same week or 2 week span, they say the Second Amendment, you can't place limitations on it, you states. There's no doubt that the Second Amendment didn't contemplate, semi-automatic weapons. So I guess I'm struggling with even if they weren't deciding that the Second Amendment case on that basis, which I don't think that they were. So I'll honestly admit that the fact that they failed to acknowledge or at least throw a clue that, hey, if you sent us an assault weapons ban, we might consider supporting that because the Second Amendment doesn't extend that far because it was never contemplated. That would at least be consistent, but they didn't do any of that, and that bothers me immensely.
David?
So, and I have to apologize if I seem a little hyper this morning. I'm here in D.C. We had a meeting at the White House with the CDC and prosecutors folks from the public health sector in what was an amazing discussion about using our influence, our collective influence, to bring some alignment between science and the law, and specifically the discussion centered around HIV and how in some states we're still criminalizing people based upon their medical status. As many of you will recall, there were legislators that went to great lengths in the 80s and 90s to criminalize people consenting adults who just happen to have the HIV. And those laws are still in the books today, and they're being weaponized in certain pockets of our country. And the reason I mention that is because I think it's a very dangerous thing whenever you criminalize health, and you do so in the absence of science. And so the idea that last Friday, prosecutors were empowered and police were empowered to now police a woman's womb and to criminalize the behavior of physicians who we cherish as a society, to me is just outrageous. And it's and it was just great violence, I think, that was perpetrated on our Constitution and in our society. And it the other thing too is that whenever we've moved the ball forward, allowing same-sex marriage, whenever we've reached these incredible decisions, it's a sign to the rest of the world of just how advanced a society we are. And to be pulled back in that way, it's painful. It's painful to watch.
Anybody else? We do have some letters.
One of the great contradictions I thought of the ruling was Alito was arguing that this will, you know, settle the chaos that was caused by Roe. But I'm when you throw it to the states, they're going to pass laws and create chaos. And then you when you get a court decision, it establishes things for years and years. That's people can come to expect it. But if you have a state legislature deciding one thing about abortion, and the next round of the state legislature, they can undo it. So you're going to go back and forth depending on what happens with state legislatures. I just think that having each state decide this and having this be at the decision of all these different states is more volatile than having a court ruling.
I agree with you there. I also think that sending it back to Congress and saying this is a congressional issue, you have the same problem, right? You're going to see probably at least one house have a change in control in a midterm, because that's how we roll, right? We like to throw power back and forth, and then you know you have another presidency. Perhaps where you've got someone with a different viewpoint, you might see it be undone. That's why I say, I mean, this is something that we ought to be talking about. If we want to establish a constitutional right, let's do it. Let's amend the Constitution and put it in there. And I know, I'm sure some people are going to say, oh, you're naive or whatever, but I think that is where the focus has to be. Get it in the Constitution. Let's not leave it to some branch of government. Let's the people amend the Constitution and make it clear.
And you think that's doable? I mean,
I think it's doable right away, but I think you have to start. I mean, just because it's hard doesn't mean you shouldn't try. I think that there's a lot of if the numbers are right, if the polling numbers are right, and you start, mm-hmm. you know, you start with a clear right that is based as a liberty interest, bodily integrity, maybe it's just up till viability, and you take that from Roe, and you say that we have that right exists regardless of what state you're in. I do think that the vast majority of the population would vote for it if they had the ability to.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to say anything else, Alan?
No, you know, I certainly agree with the sentiment. As a political scientist, though, I look at the politics as the art of the possible that has been raised a number of times. And when we talk about this, I think we owe it to ourselves to talk about what the road forward looks like. What are we going to do in order to make these perfectly sensible changes?
Yeah, I mean, Ireland legalized it. And that was through a constitutional amendment. So if they could do
it
in Ireland.
It's legal in Italy.
Yeah, I mean, if you could do it in Ireland, I mean, I think we took the responsibility off the shoulders of legislators for many years because, well, we didn't. The Supreme Court did in Roe versus mm-hmm. Wade, right? And so they got a pass. And people didn't vote based on this one issue all the time because you didn't need to, right? there's going to be some consequences at the election level. But I wonder if we wouldn't be better off if we could get it firmly established in the Constitution. It would be awfully hard to undo if it was clearly in the Constitution.
But of course, you could say that about many, many things.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please, David.
Well, the path forward is to if we're going to do the historical approach, let's look at the history of the filibuster, of the tool that has been weaponized, that has evolved into what many people now consider. Because if you ask the average person, they consider the filibuster, a tool that has been with us since the beginning of time, which is not true. This was an instrument that, again, it was the southern states that, that looked to upend the majority of the Senate, which at the time had been northern senators in states that didn't allow for slavery. And it was a tool that was an obstructionist tool that is now viewed as a legitimate weapon to be used by the minority. So you have minority rule in the Senate. And in the Senate is one of the three spaces where policies become law. And if you undermine one of the three spaces, then you can't get anything moved or passed, which is exactly where we are right now. For all intents and purposes, the Senate is a broken house, and it was supposed to be the most deliberative body. And so we always relied on the Supreme Court as the institution that was above, you know, the politics, and we relied on them to make the right call. Sometimes we didn't agree with the calls, but you know, they explained their reason and rationale, and some people could say yeah, other people could say no, but we never were really that critical of the Supreme Court. Well, what happens when the Supreme Court now, by way that you put people in the Supreme Court, is upended, as Mitch McConnell did, right? So that was the first sin, followed by, you know, the presidential politics, and look where we are now. And the Supreme Court is even discussing not taking an active role in elections and deferring election issues to state legislators. Now, the question was asked, what's the path forward? The path forward is perilous.
Yeah, and I just want to make it clear that I don't suffer from the delusion that a constitutional amendment would pass with this currently configured Congress. I mean, it would never make it through the Senate. It would unlikely make it through the House, and it would have to be both of them agreeing to it. So by 2/3. But that, I guess, my point is we got to start voting based on an issue like this if we really want there to be something firmly enshrined in the Constitution rather than, you know, just legislation each year.
You can write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Many people have. We'll share those letters with you right after this short break.
She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Friday, the 1st of July. A terrific panel before us: Alan Chartok, Heather Mulligan, I'm sorry, David Soares, and Judy Patrick. Wonderful to have you all with us. We have letters, as I promised. Kay writes to us and says, "Why isn't women's health and all people's health a privacy issue? Full stop. 14th Amendment prohibits states from making laws that infringe upon the personal autonomy protections provided in the first 13 amendments. Am I missing something?" Anyone want to address that?
No, I mean, I think that it's always described as an implied right, and that's kind of my point. If you don't spell it out, you could end up with a court like this one that says, well, it's not actually written in there exactly, so we don't think that it goes that far, and we'll leave it to the states to decide. And that's kind of where we are.
If you don't like
the constitutional interpretations are a la carte. We pick the amendments we like and we do away with the ones we don't, for reasons that as well as the writer. And so it's not implicit in the 14th Amendment, according to Alito, but the Second Amendment, yeah, allows you to carry your gun anywhere you go.
Alan?
I was just going to say, you know, it keeps coming back in my mind to how we vote in elections, particularly presidential elections, when it comes down to who is going to pick who for the Supreme Court. It is something that we have forgotten, I think, in this country. And when we get what we're getting right now, it's a pretty good reason to remember that presidents appoint members of the court.
So, as if on cue, Craig writes and says, you keep saying, not you, but I think all of us, keep saying that elections matter, but Republicans have lost the popular vote for president every time except once in the last 30 years, and yet they still get to pick the justices.
I have a solution.
Exactly. That's what it's about.
Well, I think we need to relook at the Electoral College. Some states actually split the vote based on how their popular vote went in the state. And while in New York, that means Republican candidates would probably get some Electoral College votes that they don't currently get. In a state like Florida, it wouldn't be a winner-take-all. It would be a split. And you'd see presidential candidates actually having to campaign in states where they don't right now. They just totally write like a Republican candidate writes off New York, doesn't really try. They'd have to try and campaign in states where they would have the opportunity to pick up some electoral votes. And I think you'd end up with more moderate candidates.
So are you going to give us your view of possibilities here? Do you think this is going to happen?
So I'm like living in like the my extreme fantasy, right? No, because I think both parties are going to say, well, we're not going to do that because like in New York, they say, why would we give any Electoral College votes to Republicans? Because, you know, you see, and they'll use the same argument, because the popular vote, they haven't won. Now you'd just be giving them more Electoral College votes. But I think that it's all sort of parochial self-interest. I mean, if everyone was trying to do the right thing and actually have it matter at the national level, have the Electoral College votes have real meaning, you would cast them in proportion to how the votes were cast in the state.
Scott sums all of this up fairly simply. SCOTUS decisions. First, force humans to be born. Then, kill them with guns, climate change, and pollution. Thank you, religious right, corporations, and Republicans. Frothing mad was the subject line of that particular email. Julius writes to us and says, first, the SCOTUS enabled big money to control the legislature with Citizens United. Then they gave almost absolute power to the legislature with its most recent rulings. No matter how many voters turn out, if the choice of candidates is determined by money alone, the U.S. is finished.
And the fix is?
Yeah.
And the fix is?
This will take forever, too. I mean, Ketanji Brown Jackson got sworn in yesterday, and I was thinking to myself, it's going to be decades before, you know, she's really going to be able to make a difference. I can imagine being 51 years old and thinking, you know, you're going to spend another 30 years maybe in this particular job, and you're sitting there with, you know, with that kind of in that kind of minority, and it's you know, only three liberal votes.
Be one of the three. David is writing to David. David writes to David Soares, a few weeks ago you called America the most democratic country in the world. Given minority rule fostered with the Senate, the Electoral College, and lifetime judicial appointments, I feel this statement needs defending.
Listen, I said at the very beginning, the first words out of my mouth. And by the way, let me just get a little bit emotional and sentimental here. I happened to come to this country. I arrived on these shores in November of 1975, having come from some other place. And so when you come from some other place and you get to live the life that I have lived, to change the trajectory of my personal life, but that of my family, my children, there is something really special about our nation. And the 4th is one of the most celebrated holidays in my home. And that's part of the reason I'm a little bit bitter today. I'm sad because as a student of history, and there's some beauty and majesty to the Madisonian form of government.
And if it's allowed to function as it is allowed, as it's supposed to function, to get us to this space in time, then it works. But when you begin to reverse engineer, like through gerrymandering, right, and through filibusters, you are rotting out, you know, the very chambers and institutions that we rely on for this nation to work. Think of it as a beautiful engine. Right. It goes fast sometimes. It goes slow. Sometimes it breaks down. But we keep moving forward. But if you're not putting the proper fuel, or if you're tweaking certain things in that engine, it's going to break. What we have right now are 40 senators, right, that prevent anything from moving forward. And you could do it with 40 senators, not 51, but with 40, and or 41 rather. And the filibuster is gone. Like Heather had mentioned, the politics, it's going to change. The polls are going to bring different people into power. It's frightening in some communities, you know. But like, we live in New York State. We're going to remain, you know, largely unaffected by all of this. But Missouri, Arkansas, you know, so. Yes, I think that amendments, I think that legislation, it can definitely put with the contours of Roe, could definitely, you know, bring us back to where we were, and bringing women back to enjoy their full rights as American citizens. But I don't see that in this climate, especially when we continue to allow, and this is both Democrats and Republicans, to manipulate the curvature of districts to, you know, give them advantages, when we allow for endless, you know, dark money to come into our politics to influence the decisions, and it keeps certain people in power. We have a long road ahead of us, but we have to tackle the very instruments that undermine the Madisonian form of government.
A couple more letters before we go to the top of the hour break, and then we will do that and come back and tackle a new topic. Don't worry, it'll be just as depressing. MK says, originally there were 9 Supreme Court justices because we had 9 circuit courts. We now have 13. We absolutely have to expand the court. AOC is correct. This is a judicial coup, SCOTUS enacting the will of the GOP.
Well, the problem is that when you start to fool around with the number of people on the court, you know, sooner or later, whoever happens to have the upper hand at a moment will be calling the shots. So you have to be very careful when you start to talk about numbers of people on a court.
Deborah writes to us and says, at least 3 nominees to the court lied under oath about their views of settled law regarding Roe.
Would seem so.
There are 2 justices on the court. Through contrary Senate procedures and originalism is a morally and legally bankrupt philosophy, since the document was focused only on the rights of white landholding men, many of whom were slaveholders. The document moves with a society, or it means nothing. Kathleen says, so the Supreme Court has compelled women who are raped to carry their pregnancies to term. They have made it legal for people to bring concealed weapons on the New York City subway. They have said it's okay to expel pollutants that will cause cancer and lower life expectancy. How are we to think that these people are not evil? Finally, before we take a break, we go to Carrie's letter, who says, yes, this was a searingly difficult week. But one thing that the Supreme Court did is expose the extreme right and their plan to dismantle the federal government's protection of individual rights they don't like. Everyone I know is now talking about states' rights and theocracy, when 2 weeks ago there was no one discussing those 2 things.
Great point.
A silver lining from Carrie. Very nice way to end hour 1 of our panel. Don't worry, we'll be back. First, Ray Graffin News. I dare you to be in a bad mood after hearing that. I dare you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, Albany County District Attorney David Soares, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have, I want to move on to some new topics here and talk about some other stuff, and we'll get to some letters too. I want to discuss the concern. This was brought up during the hearing earlier this week with Cassidy Hutchinson, the January 6th hearing. At the end, this was broached by Liz Cheney, and now is more is coming out about how this is being done. But the concern about witness tampering and what pressure is being put on witnesses who are going before the committee from the Trump camp and those who are pro-Trump, his allies. So from the Washington Post, as rumors flew in the spring of 2018 that Donald Trump's longtime lawyer Michael Cohen was preparing to flip on his former boss and offer potentially damaging testimony to federal prosecutors, Cohen received an email. "You are loved," read the email, which indicated it was relaying comments from former Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani and was quoted in special counsel Robert Mueller's 2019 report. "Sleep well tonight. You have friends in high places," it said. It was one of a number of times messages of cajoling support or bullying encouragement were delivered to potentially important Mueller witnesses. And it was strikingly similar to the communications that Representative Liz Cheney said on Tuesday had been received by witnesses who have testified for the House committee investigating the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Evidence across multiple state, federal, and congressional investigations point to a similar pattern. Trump and his close allies privately shower potential witnesses with flattery and attention, extending vague assurances that staying loyal to Trump would be better than crossing him. Meanwhile, Trump publicly blasts those who offer testimony against him in bluntly personal terms, offering a clear example to others of the consequences of, quote, stepping out of line. "Donald Trump never changes his playbook," Cohen says in an interview. "He behaves like a mob boss, and these messages are fashioned in that style, giving an order without giving the order, no fingerprints attached." David Soares.
These people are just, it's so breathtakingly stupid. Look, the issue here, you know, the issue here is exactly what was said. What was the language used, right? Because, you know, in order to establish witness tampering, you know, you have to establish the intent to influence a witness's testimony. That could either be done with threat or reward. And so I think the example that is quoted, at least in this story, you know, takes you right up to that line. I don't know without more whether or not it actually crosses that line. But after watching the hearing the other day, I'm convinced that by the fall there will be indictments, and there has to be. I think the temperature again weeks ago had been turned on very high for Merrick Garland's Department of Justice. I think it's boiling over now, where, like I said, by the fall, there has to be indictments on people like Giuliani and Trump and that cohort.
So, David, do you see this kind of witness tampering in your shop?
We don't see it. I mean, this is. I'd like to say we have a much more intelligent base of criminals than we have in Washington.
Wow.
granted, there are certain people that violate orders of protection, right? These are folks that demonstrate that they can't resist their impulses, right? But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here are supposed very intelligent people who continue to do Donald Trump's bidding. Like, here, call this person that's been subpoenaed to appear before Congress and provide testimony under oath, and let them know how much we love them. And that person actually goes and dials that phone. It's just amazing to me. But I also think that if folks are willing to make that call, then I guarantee you that somewhere is going to be that, that bit of evidence that puts it over the line where you're going to see or you're going to hear about a threat or a reward.
You know, there's some indication that Trump World is helping to pay for the lawyers that are helping the witnesses come forward. And I know lawyers are bound by a set of ethics that requires them to represent or to work in the best interests of their client. But it's got to be in the back of the mind of the witnesses that, you know, I can't afford this lawyer. I'm glad that they're there and I don't want that money to be taken away.
I think it's just got this creepy sort of organized crime and or domestic abuse sort of feel to it, right? That, you know, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of you. You're the best. You know, we trust you. And then if you don't toe the line, you're going to get basically, you know, publicly vilified and potentially ruined.
Yeah, the creepiest line was like to Michael Cohen was sleep well tonight. It's like, well, don't sleep well if you do the opposite. Which is creepy.
Sleep with the fishes.
This isn't Francis Ford Coppola mob movie, though. This is like the Hallmark Channel, like C-rated actors, and it's the worst organized crime film I've ever seen, starring Donald Trump, where you have one attorney that knocks on everybody's door, representing everyone, and when you say now, granted. When you have multiple defendants in a case, the attorneys that are representing those multiple defendants will generally enter into a sharing agreement, right, which information they're going to pass along to one another in efforts to assist, you know, their clients. And there's nothing wrong with that. But here you obviously see strategically that Trump having one attorney represent all of those that were closest to him is actually a very good legal strategy, because those attorneys are sitting in those depositions and listening to the questions and knowing how, you know, the assistants are going to respond. That's a treasure trove of information that is going back to Donald Trump. But Donald Trump can't resist being who he is, and therefore, I think this strategy will eventually end up blowing up in his face like it did on Tuesday or Monday at that hearing.
Yeah, Cassidy Hutchinson's fired her Trump-supplied lawyer because he discouraged her from being as forthcoming as she wanted to be. She got another lawyer, and that is presumably why she decided to come forward and divulge more of what she knew about what happened leading up to January 6th and on that actual day. It's eerie. And a lot of people still work for Trump or work at Mar-a-Lago or work for one of his PACs. I mean, Mark Meadows is still, there's this mysterious payment to Mark Meadows through the PAC of $1 million. And so when you get money from a source, what kind of allegiance does that give you that may supersede your allegiance to the truth?
It's just love. It's just love. Appreciation. That's the thing. It's just scary. It's got this weird, I don't know, this undertone of, and I get what Dave is saying. Yeah, it's the Hallmark version of it, but ugh.
Yeah, and having Trump come forth and calling somebody a whack job or he doesn't know, I mean, that wouldn't bother me much, but if the whole world knows it, and then the Trump groupies start to attack you as well, then it can be intimidating, especially to a 25 or 26-year-old who's out there who doesn't have a ton of money to provide security 24/7. I hope she has a good 4th of July is all I can say.
Sleep well. Alan, anything else you'd like to add to that?
No, I think the panel, as usual, is absolutely brilliant.
All right, let's go to a couple of letters, and then we'll move on to other stuff here. Panel at WAMC.org is where you can write to us. This is on the Roe v. Wade decision. Maude says, what are your thoughts as to the implication the recent decision may have in terms of end-of-life choices? Will we be forced into heroic interventions in the face of terminal diagnosis? And what about medically assisted suicide? Is that now off the table? Do my decisions along these lines not fall under HIPAA protection? So many questions. Thank you for all the fine discussions.
Everything's off the table.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a, you know, the smart alecky answer is that it seems if it's not directly impacting a woman, it's not as much on the radar for them that it is. We're talking about overall end of life, for men included. David?
It's Handmaid's Tale. I mean, it's like 2022, and we have to talk about creating an underground railroad for women who are seeking to make medical decisions for themselves. It is so startling. What a letdown.
We go to AC. Not you, though, I don't think, Alan. Could you give
Andrew Cuomo?
Could you give a brief run through on what? I think probably that's unlikely as well. Yeah. But we don't know. Could you give a brief run through on what issues further right Republicans have with Cheney and what issues Democrats have with Cheney that she would need to overcome if she were to make a run for the next presidential election?
Well, her presence in a particular party is right on the online. I mean, do you really think that the Republicans who have lined up to follow Trump are going to be supportive of Cheney at this stage?
And meanwhile, read what she had to say about the Supreme Court decision on the overturning of Roe v. Wade and see how many Democrats are going to go, oh, okay.
Right. I mean, I think that... unfortunately, the party is to the right of her, and there's going to be assuming you know that Trump becomes a non-viable candidate. There's going to be a whole bunch of people who are going to be more likely to win a Republican primary than Liz Cheney. You know, even if you were just in the abstract, were to think of it as a possibility, I think you know you're going to have a DeSantis in there. You're probably going to have some Ted Cruz aspirations, even though I think he would have no chance. But, you know, yeah. and then Chris Christie. I mean, you've got a whole
Mike
bunch
Pence
of.
Said,
yeah,
I
yeah, mean, yeah, yeah.
See, I see the Republican Party moderating in the future. Maybe not be next year or the year after, but I think in 5 or 10 years they will come back.
They have to the
they
middle. Absolutely have
and
to.
I think Cheney would be a good candidate for them at that point. She is conservative. She's not a moderate Republican by any means, but she would be palatable if they moderate. And that's not going to happen right away, but they have to. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, other than Cruz, everyone I named is probably, well, maybe not DeSantis. I was going to say more moderate than the former president, but DeSantis, no. But I mean, it just highlights the problem with the primary system, too, is you end up having to kind of go to the fringe of the party to get through the primary system in a lot of places. And that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is when you do think about the Republican Party. First of all, it's going to be a lot more difficult to get the Republican Party back than people think. I mean, Trump has unleashed this poisonous venom into the bloodstream of the Republican Party, and Chris Christie or even a Mitt Romney may step up and want to do something, or even a Mike Pence. But I don't think the people are going to be there for those guys unless you are absolutely echoing the insane, bigoted sort of and tethered to that, to Trump, like a DeSantis. I don't know that we're going to see the Republican Party, you know, right the ship anytime soon. I think people like Liz Cheney, who, by the way, I mean, I disagree with everything that Liz Cheney supports. I mean, she is, by all, you know, by her own record, one of the most conservative Republicans, you know, in government. Therefore, there's no agreement there. But you just have to respect the fact that she respects the institution. And so I think my hat's off there. But she's going to be in Congress for the near future. I don't see the Republican Party at a national stage changing anytime soon.
I do think, to Judy's point, I think there's going to have to be some moderation of the party, because I think that this Supreme Court decision is going to become now a factor in particular in the House, in areas where, you know, Republicans have been elected in districts that are sort of evenly balanced. In a lot of places, being on the wrong side of choice is going to be very problematic for them.
Anybody else?
I don't know. I don't know. I just have a sense that the Republican people who have been out there are supporting the Republican candidates that some of us abhor. I don't see it changing. I wish I knew why you folks were saying that.
Well, if only Republicans voted in presidential elections for Republican candidates, we would not have had a President Donald Trump. I mean, it's the people who are, like me, disenfranchised, I suppose. Yeah, I'm not true. A member of any party. I don't get to vote in primaries, but
unless you live in Massachusetts, which is a very good state,
right? And I, by the way, support the idea of open primaries. I know there's room for mischief, but I think that the mm-hmm. risks there are better than what we currently have. So, but I think the reality is that you have a whole bunch of the middle that did vote to the right, and I think there's obviously. Pre the Supreme Court stuff, there's a lot of prognostication that the middle was going to go vote to the right again because of inflation and because of some of the, because of some of the border issues and Ukraine and all of that. I think that calculus has changed, and I think people are, it's on their radar again, that this is an important issue and that we should vote based on it. And I think that's going to have a moderating influence on the party, because if it's not, they're done. I mean, over time, they're done.
All right. Let's go to David. Did you want to say something?
No, I agree with Heather's analysis. I think the only thing, I'm hanging around with my favorite AC, Mr. Shartok, because he used to always, question the political nature and influence on the Supreme Court, and I'd say, no, this is a sacred place. They don't do that. They're above it all. But I'm there now.
One leg at a time. Yeah.
One leg at a time. My fear is again that we have the very left of the Democratic Party putting out, platforms like defund the police and things like that, that really will disincentivize some moderates in both parties from voting for Democratic candidates. And so that's my only concern.
That's a good concern.
Let's see. Let's go to this letter from... Oh, did I already read this? Yes, I already did read that. My sincere apologies on that. So we'll go to this letter. Liz Cheney is not a moderate. She is an honest, smart Republican. Governor Charlie Baker and Governor Larry Hogan are moderates who might make a run for president. And
wait a second now. Liz Cheney is a Republican of the old sort. And they're out there. They are not in command right now, but they are out there. And you better believe that when you add them all up, Bush, the Bushes and the others are behind Cheney and not behind the Trumpists. That's for sure.
All right, Alan, I'm reading this letter just for you, okay?
All right.
This is a gift. I'm putting this ball on a tee, and I'm just going to let you swing as hard as you want at it, all right?
All right.
Your bias and hatred is on full display, panel. We get it. You hate Trump and you hate half the country. have the guts to air the other side. You all are the exact reason we support Trump and his policies. We don't trust you or the rest of the media, and you're doing nothing to change that. Be well, Marxists. We still love you, Steve.
I don't like you. Well, that's fine, but I don't like you.
Yes, simple as that. All right.
I just want to admit, I'm married to a Republican.
Yes.
And
yeah,
I've had many conversations with Republicans who do not like what former President Trump did. They find him trying to usurp an election horrible. They didn't like some of his approaches to what he did. But there's a lot of Republicans out there who still believe in conservative principles, and they're not every Republican is a member of the Trump cult.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our discussion this morning with our great group. We welcome you. Say hi to the baby for us, David. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Heather Mulligan, David Soares, and Judy Patrick. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We have just about 15 minutes left with our group, so I'm going to make the most of it. I want to get to some new topics. Two letters that I didn't get to before the break, so I'll read those and then we'll move on. Suzanne says Liz Cheney will probably lose in November, and the idea that Trump is far right politically is wrong. His cult followers who worship him are the far right ones. James says, I wish Cheney had preemptively highlighted at the end of Hutchinson's testimony, America, just watch. We all know what this is about, what is about to happen. Watch as they call all of this lies and fake news. Wake up. This is their playbook. All right. Let's move on to other topics. We go over to we can talk about what happened in what won't happen. We can talk about the Supreme Court wanting to hear a case on state legislature's power over elections. We can talk about that, or we can talk about Biden saying definitively that we need to end the filibuster. Which would you like to discuss?
Either one.
Okay, David, do you have a choice, David?
We'll take a filibuster for 100, Joe.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. Biden, chiding courts, endorses ending filibuster to codify abortion rights. The president called the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade destabilizing and said Congress needed to act to codify it into law. He condemned what he called the outrageous behavior of the Supreme Court in overturning Roe v. Wade and said for the first time that he supported ending the filibuster to protect a woman's right to an abortion and a broader constitutional right to privacy. It was a striking assertion from a president who is steeped in the traditions of the Senate and has resisted calls from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party to scrap the longstanding Senate practice of requiring 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. But in chiding the justices for a decision he called destabilizing for the country, the president said it was time to push Congress to act. We have to codify Roe v. Wade in the law, and the way to do that is to make sure the Congress votes to do that. And if the filibuster gets in the way, it's like voting rights. We provide an exception for this or an exception to the filibuster for this action. Alan, let's begin with you.
Well, he's right. The question, of course, is
how do you do it, right?
Yeah, I mean, how do you make it happen? The fact is, we're looking at this. We see how the country has been shanghaied by a set of, you know, antique rules, and this is something that needs to be done, like so many other things that need to be done. The question is, can we do it?
Heather?
Yeah, I think I agree that this is an issue where you should suspend the filibuster. However, understand that, you know, as I mentioned previously, you could have a flip-flop, right? You change the leadership in in Congress, and you could end up having it just go back the other way.
Yep.
I do think, though, if the numbers, the polling numbers are correct and they hold, that, again, this will be a moderating influence on Republicans, and they will actually have to say where they are on this issue in order to get elected. And, it's, I mean, same for Democrats. There are some conservative pro-life Democrats, not as many. But I think that at least they'll be forced to state their position.
David?
There is no path forward for Joe Biden. There is no path forward for Joe Biden and any of his policies with the status quo. The filibuster is a device. And by the way, as a traditionalist in the Senate, the senators love the filibuster, okay? Because the filibuster provides each and every one of them with more power than they've ever had in the past. And so they all enjoy the filibuster. But there is no path forward for the Biden administration and any of his policies that he wants to move forward now that he has a Supreme Court that is there to the right that will strike down most of his executive orders. And that's his only path forward is through Congress. And with the filibuster in the Senate, he has no hope. And so I knew that this would eventually come and he would take a more declarative position on it.
Biden has to do, he had to do something, even though it was a useless effort. I mean, he had to be perceived as taking some measure to fight this, but my eyes glaze over every time I hear the word filibuster in this dispute in the Senate. It was drilled into my head growing up that you needed a 2/3 vote to approve treaties in the Senate. And, it, you know, let's decide. If you need a majority vote to approve something, let's just go with that. And you know, if you vote in a Republican-led Senate, so be it. This whole filibuster, every time it comes up, I have to go back to Wikipedia to try to learn about what it is again. It's not actually to approve a bill. It's to end discussion and to move an you know, it's a procedural move, and it seems crazy that this is what binds us up.
I don't know. Could he even get it? I just wonder with Manchin and Sinema, I mean, could he even get that? They have to agree, right?
It's dead on arrival. He has no. There are other things he could do to show some leadership on abortion, but he's not doing that.
But is he right to say it?
Is he right to say it? I mean, because people will call him out saying there's nothing behind the curtain here. You can call for it and people can make it can be a one day story, but you know it's not going to go anywhere.
Well, I don't think
it's going to go anywhere, but I do think that it turns the heat up on Sinema and Manchin, both of whom, you know, approvingly gave the thumbs up for some of these justices to be installed in the Supreme Court. Now, Manchin, I think, was really the first one out of the gate, along with Collins, to talk about how he had been duped. You know, Joe Biden could put this back on Manchin by continuing to harp on the filibuster. I think it would put more public pressure on those two senators.
Those guys are heat resistant. They've been under a lot of pressure to change before, and they just don't bend.
I wonder if you could get, though, a Collins or someone to you know, basically team up with the Democrats on this issue. Just wonder.
People have been holding their breath on that one for quite a while.
David, would you like to opine on Susan Collins? David, I will take Susan Collins' spine for $500.
It's too bad Judith isn't here. I know she's a huge fan, right?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, no. No, it's like a horse that comes in last. You know, do not put your money on the Susan Collins horse.
Let's see. Chris writes to us and says, any Democrat who thinks using restraint regarding the filibuster is going to keep Republicans from scrapping it the moment they next come to power is simply delusional. That from Chris. All right. Well, we are going to run out of time here in a few minutes, but I want to end with this story. You know, it is 4th of July, and one of the cherished parts of that tradition.
Hot dogs? Are we talking hot dogs?
Hot dogs, apple pie, James Taylor at Tanglewood. Great things that go on in our region. But, of course, fireworks. And as if there is not enough bad news in the world, the pandemic has caused a shortage in fireworks.
Yay.
I agree with you. There is, I think, you know, I don't know. This is a very anecdotal statement, but it seems as though fireworks tend to be going the way of the clown, in the sense that one time the clown was, we always like enjoyed the clown, and now then the clown became really scary and maniacal, and we hate the clown and we hate balloons and we don't like that. Okay, so now fireworks are running into this as well. Yes, they light up the night sky. They make it beautiful. It is something that puts us in awe. However, the president of a Maryland fireworks display company, I think one of the largest in the world, says that port staffing issues in China delayed their shipment and called other fireworks companies to buy any extra stock, but they didn't have any. Three quarters of the rockets, Roman candles, and Camaros... Anyone? Okay. That they will need for...
spelled wrong.
Right. You're right. We'll need for a busy Independence Day schedule of shows from places all over the Mid-Atlantic states are still stuck in shipping containers that might reach her, this is the vendor, only hours before the event, and maybe... not at all. Demand for fireworks displays surged past pre-pandemic levels this year as cities and counties push to finally return to normal after 2 years of Independence Day celebrations stifled by the coronavirus. Stymied by supply chain issues, those celebrations are in jeopardy as fireworks display businesses, still hurting from the downturn, cannot secure enough product or staff to meet the demand. Heather, you seem happy about this.
I am. I have a dog that is an absolute mess every time there's fireworks. And you know what? If there was only fireworks one day a year or even 2 days a year and I could just, you know, give him some medication and ride it out, that would be fine. But I've got neighbors who it's the 4th of July every Friday and every Saturday. So I'm glad there's a shortage. I'm not going to lie. I know that makes me a party pooper, but I know there's a lot of animals and people who are very unnerved by them.
Take that, neighbors.
Yeah.
The entire, you know, I have to say, I mean, I agree with you. I have to say that displays that are in towns and that are organized displays are usually delightful. They bring the towns together. If you don't want to bring your dog, you don't bring your dog. You do them out, hopefully out away from people and away from neighborhoods, and you can you know, take care of a lot of that. And if you live in a neighborhood where you know for an hour they're going to have fireworks, you can bring the dog elsewhere, and those things are fine. But, oh, man, the neighbors who have the fireworks and where they get them, God knows, New Hampshire, that they bring them in, and that is, they start, like, it'll start tonight, right?
Yep.
And then go right through.
It started last weekend.
Yeah, you're right. And it just goes through right through the weekend. And that's not only disturbing for animals, but for...
veterans, for example.
Veterans, elderly people. Babies. Babies who are just put to sleep. I know, David, you can't associate with this, but just put to sleep, and then boom, not good. So
oh, I know. I think there's a legion of dogs that are sitting on this incredible stockpile, and led by Wile E. Coyote, you know, sitting there like with all of the Acme stuff, man. And it's like I agree with Heather. You know, I like it when it's downtown somewhere and there's an event, you know, by a beach, but boy, having it around your neighborhood, it is just, it's awful.
And people in emergency rooms, doctors in emergency room will probably be happy that they'll have fewer injuries coming in the next few days.
I meant to look this up before we had this discussion. Now I don't remember, but did the firework rules change in New York?
No, there's, you can still buy them at your local grocery store.
I see them in the Hannaford, but have the type of and other grocery stores.
You can buy more stuff than you used to be able to,
yeah.
Like a lot bigger stuff.
Right.
And there's, I don't know, I think there's some time limits But, I mean, you can buy it now and save it till, you know, the middle of November if you want.
You can buy it, I think, a week before 4th of July and a week before New Year's.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that that's the only time
no,
you can.
No, absolutely. Yeah, right, no, but those are times you can buy them where they're actually on display. All right. Well, however you choose to celebrate your 4th of July holiday, I hope you do it beautifully. I hope you do it safely. And I hope you enjoy the togetherness that can come with such holidays. And if you're traveling anywhere, be safe. Drive carefully. Let the person in. If you know, and don't be the guy. Just let him in. And I know they make you mad because they went up on the side shoulder.
Exactly.
And you just want to say, look, screw you. I'm not going to let you in. But you know what? Just let them in. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Have a beautiful weekend. Alan, thank you very much. Enjoy the grandchildren.
Too.
Love to all of them. David, safe travels back. You're back to Albany today?
Yes. Thank
Excellent.
You.
All right. Yes. Safe travels for you and the family. Judy, Heather, thank you very much. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be back right after this.